Straight Shooter with Stephen A.
Welcome. Hour number two, Straight Shooter in the house with yours truly, Stephen A. Coming at you as I love to do every Wednesday night from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time over the airwaves of Sirius XM, POTUS Radio, channel 124. It is my honor and privilege to have my next guest on the line on with me right now. He's been on here before. He's going to be on here in the future. I will openly confess to you, he's a friend. You know, his brother's great. He's great. I've known him for years, got a lot of love for him, and looking forward to having this conversation with him. He served as the White House Chief of Staff during Obama's first term, Mayor of Chicago, and most recently, U.S. Ambassador to Japan. He is now a senior political and global affairs commentator for CNN. Please welcome back to Straight Shooter, the one and only Rahm Emanuel. How are you, buddy? How's everything going?
I'm good, Stephen. And you?
I'm doing great. Let me get right to it, because I was reading this article in the Wall Street Journal that you wrote. It's titled, "The U.S. Military Needs Another Revolution." That's what it says here. And my first question, before I asked the question, there was a graph that stood out. And I wanted to read this graph because I want people to get this. You were talking about the military. And you said the command structure has elevated some of America's most talented sons and daughters into positions of authority. When I worked with Army Chief of Staff General Randy George and Admiral Lisa Franchetti as the ambassador to Japan, I saw why so many people around the world believe America's military is diplomatically sophisticated, strategically wise, and operationally unmatched. Unfortunately, the Trump administration is discarding that talent. I want you to speak to that and speak to the state of affairs you think our military exists right now, presently, with our military.
I come from the basis, look, I have two kids that are part of the U.S. Armed Forces in the Navy, both now reservists. I've seen this, I'll tell you this, everybody writes about the greatest turnaround, this company, this basketball team. Single greatest turnaround in American history is the U.S. Armed Forces. Took the breadth and depth of all of America. After Vietnam, it was flat on its back. It was broken spiritually. It was broken structurally. It was broken on discipline. And in the 40-year trajectory, it is the marvel and the ace and the gold standard around the globe. And I believe, and I saw the talent. I saw Lisa Franchetti. I seen, obviously, the General Green. You just look at this talent, and they were admired, respected operationally, diplomatically, strategically, and execution-wise. And now, under Secretary of Defense Hegseth and Donald Trump, 20-plus military leaders, for no reason, have been fired. Now, you would have saw that in China or Russia. We're destroying the actual merit-based system, the only institution that the American people actually respect and hold above 50%. Everything else, me, you, media, financial institutions, corporate America, nowhere close above 40. The military, and they're actually breaking the one thing that the American people actually hold in high esteem and regard for good reason. They earned it the hard way. And so that to me is number one. Number two, beyond just the, you know, it's not just I have a patriot system. It is the people you invest in, the people you elevate because of the capacity. And then what I also talked about is when you looked at the system, the United States was supposed to be able to fight two wars simultaneously. And now we have to get to a place where we have to fight two different type of wars simultaneously. Mm. Neither Iran or Ukraine have a navy, and they control the waters on their borders, the Strait of Hormuz and the Black Sea. So when the president says, oh, Iran's navy is at the bottom of the ocean, that is true. But you still can't open the Strait of Hormuz. So you're going to have what this old system, which is a Goldwater Nichols revolution, that actually allows us to fight a conventional, unconventional in two different theaters, two different times, and sometimes in the same theater. And it needs a revolution, not the destruction of the greatest talent that's ever been assembled since World War II.
But define what a revolution, when you say the word revolution, for those that don't comprehend what specifically you're saying as to what should be done, what is that exactly? What does that look like?
Well, take a look at the three things that I made out. Well, and I want to use this as a benchmark. Russia is 10 times the size of Ukraine. The war now from Russia's invasion of Ukraine has lasted longer than Russia's invasion of Berlin in the 40s. They have used asymmetrical warfare to hold off and now are starting to gain more territory than Russia's gaining. Russia's losing 50,000 troops a month, and Ukraine is gaining 200 square miles a year. That tells you why we're not ahead on Asia. Do we have Patriots? Yes. Do we have the THAAD? Yes. Do we have the F-35? We need that, and we need Navy ships. Yes, we need all of that and more. Number one, we have inculcated with the Big Five military-industrial complex failure as a business model. Nothing is on time or on budget. 6 years, no CEO in the corporate suite get any stock buybacks at all until they fix the broken system that we have insured. Number two, all new technology. You wall off 40% of it so the Big Five cannot compete, and you start actually seed capitalizing new startups in drone, cyber, and all the other new technology. And that type of stuff will also bring young men off the couch, out of the basement, and be part of something that's important for the national security of America. That revolution. Now, we failed a touchstone here. In the 80s, we invaded Grenada. We found out that our Air Force couldn't talk to our Navy. Our Navy couldn't talk to our Army. That's what started Goldwater Nichols rethinking and integrating. And you saw the execution of that and the capacity of that in Venezuela. We were in space. We were in air. We were on Navy. We were in the Marines. We were in helicopters. And we were in cyber. An integrated communication system that actually did not lose a single person or a single piece of equipment. We can't do that today. We are 20 times the size of Iran, and they now have the nuclear option called the Strait of Hormuz. So we need a revolution in thinking.
When Iran says that they stand to profit more by controlling the Strait of Hormuz as it compared to them simply exporting oil, are they telling the truth when they say that?
Absolutely. Their whole theory and the basis here, and the reason Bahrain, Qatar, and everybody has a basis from the United States, is they are a Persian empire of Shiite religious views. The rest of the Gulf is Sunni views, do not want the Persian empire that they have history with. They, number two, have, since the revolution of 79, have been determined to kick America out of the Gulf so they can dominate. So when they say we own the Strait of Hormuz, where Kuwait, UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, Oman, all get, not Oman, but all get their oil out and their energy and their fertilizer and their jet fuel, all of that out, one-fifth of the world's energy supply. That control would give them control of the world economy. And it's a checkmate, if not, it was, I call it, the nuclear option on not only the world economy, but the United States. And that's why this was, I think, a war of choice and a bad war. But they're not wrong, because they discovered what they didn't think they had or implied that they had, and now they know they have it.
Well, let me ask you this, Rahm Emanuel. You're a Jewish American, and let me ask you this. Trump is, it's believed, has worked in concert with Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister for Israel, on all of this when he chose to. First, he bombed him and bombed the nuclear sites last June, swore up and down they were obliterated. And then the next thing you know, he did it again. And he went after them again because obviously they were fearful of Iran having a nuclear weapon within a month. Number one, did you ever believe those reports that they were on the verge of having a nuclear weapon within a month? And number two, were you supportive of the initial strike?
In June?
Against Iran. So,
in June.
Yes. I'm not in June. The second go round is what I'm asking.
That's different. No, I wasn't. So, and I'll tell you why. One is, in a very simple way, let's look at the before and after. Iran had spent billions and billions of dollars and lost Syria, and their public was furious. Hezbollah was back on its heels. They have had five uprisings in 12 years, and each uprising they have had to kill more and more of their own people, to the point that for the first time, this last one, the Iranian youth and the Iranian merchants and the middle class were aligned against the government. They had no support in society. Their economy was crushing back and falling apart. They had an 89-year-old head of state who had terminal cancer. They had no succession plan. They were isolated politically, isolated economically, isolated from their own people, and strategically on their back foot. They offered everything on the nuclear table that we wanted in Vienna, and that has all been documented. Now, I know one thing, being a mayor, being a chief of staff, and a senior advisor to two presidents, been in the Oval Office for 8 years. You know what ends up in the Oval Office, Stephen A.? Bad and worse. Those are your only two choices, and you have to have the judgment smart people around you, the ability to push and ask and learn from mistakes and say, is this bad or is this worse and how do I turn it? This, we literally had them in a corner. We got them out of the corner with this. This was a mistake. This was a war of choice. They had a separation between the government that had to kill more and more Iranians every 2 years to stay in power. Why would you get, what? You know the rule of politics. When your enemy or opponent is in the middle of a knife fight with themselves, don't get in the middle of it.
Right.
Let them go. And that's what we did. We got in the middle of it and saved them.
Okay, so asking you, a supporter of Israel, do you hold Trump most accountable for that, or do you hold Benjamin Netanyahu as accountable as you hold Trump?
I hold the president of the United States because he has agency. He has the responsibility for the American people's and our country's national interest. Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, has shopped that policy to Joe Biden, turned it down. To Donald Trump, won, turned it down. To Barack Obama, turned it down. To George Bush, turned it down. And my memory serves me correctly, a variation of this to President Clinton and turned down. But definitely four presidents have all looked at that plan, weighed bad and worse, equity and liabilities, and said no. Now, so I never, ever give a president a pass. They have agency. Mm-hmm. He could have said no. The prime minister of Israel has shopped this plan to four presidents, including Donald Trump 1.0, and all four said, no, there's another alternative. And in this case, when we did the June bombing, we succeeded in actually creating the conditions where the public were breaking, the society of Iran was breaking from their own government. They were isolated in the region. Their economy was crushed, and their surrogate and proxy terrorists were broken. And according to the president, defense intelligence said something else, their nuclear capacity was obliterated. That was what was before this endeavor.
Let me move on. Rahm Emanuel right here on Straight Shooter with Stephen A. Let me move to China because that's where the president is right now. You served as U.S. ambassador to Japan. What is your assessment of the long-term strategic threat posed by China?
Well, they have it's a very serious threat, both politically, diplomatically, militarily, and economically. And they have a very clear strategy. They're going to pursue it long term to replace the United States as the primary military, economic, and political power in the world. Iran, to your further point, has given them, as reported, has given them a unique opening. They're serving energy resources and electricity with solar and wind to the rest of the world while oil is being cut off. They are a helping hand rather than the problem. They have actually now been seen as a place of stability where we're now the chaos machine. So then militarily, while we are focused on the Strait of Hormuz, they're owning the South China Sea, and they've put the Philippines and Vietnam, a treaty ally of the Philippines, at risk with us. We have taken military equipment out of South Korea, out of Japan, meant as a deterrent in the region, and moved it all to the Middle East. So on the win-loss record, again, I think that in the China thing, we know they're a threat. And here's the thing. And I say this everywhere I go, Stephen A. When I was ambassador to Japan, I learned a lot about the country. I learned a lot about the Indo-Pacific. I learned the most about the United States. I'm not scared of China. I'm scared of what America is not doing. China does not decide if 50% of our kids cannot read at grade level. We decide. China does not decide whether we cut the research universities and the NIH and National Science Foundation and the cures for cancer and the next energy capability. We decide. China does not decide whether we have only oil and gas or we have all the above energy. We decide. China is pursuing what's in China's interest. We are forfeiting the game in the competition. Never bet against America, but we have decided to bet against America by giving up, throwing in the towel. So do they want to replace us? Yes. You don't have to be paranoid.
But how are we throwing
and
in the
we
towel?
We are not competing.
But how are we throwing in a towel? How are we throwing in a towel?
I'll give you an example. I'm gonna just one little anecdote to illustrate this point.
Sure.
The other day, the New York Times said there was a miracle drug that is now curing pancreatic cancer, colon cancer, and all these other cancers. It's the riddle to the biggest problem we have in health, life sciences. Started with National Institute of Health funding. We're arguing about redistricting. And China's doubling their research into life sciences, and the president of the United States has proposed a 40% cut in the National Institute of Health, the gold standard around the globe for life sciences. Number two, we've cut the National Science Foundation by 25% and we've fired the board. Now, I propose ways to double the funding for all of those. That's forfeiting. When it comes to our kids and our research, when I started in politics, we weren't sure what to do on education, but everybody was ready to try it and experiment and be a reformer. Today, based on the Mississippi model that you and I have talked about before, we can actually take in our kids and teach them again how to read, but we lost the political will. We forfeited. We become complacent with failure. This is a country built on the ethos, failure is not an option, and we have accepted failure as a business model in our military-industrial complex, in the fact that we can't teach kids to read at third grade, and we've allowed our kids to basically be absent from schools. We're cutting our research. We've decided not to compete on the energy field, but to double down on one source. That's what I mean by forfeiting. Don't ever bet against America, but you got to actually get in the game. China is pursuing China's interest. We have given up on pursuing America's interest. And President Trump's personal relationships is not America's national security. It's his personal interest.
Rahm Emanuel, former chief of staff under the for the White House under the Barack Obama administration, former mayor of Chicago, right here with Straight Shooter with yours truly, Stephen A. I want to go to the blue city issue, Rahm. You were a Law and Order Democrat who prioritized fiscal pragmatism in Chicago. Today, many Democratic-run cities are struggling, obviously, with crime, disorder, affordability under a very different ideological approach than one you exercise. Does the Rahm Emanuel model of urban governance even exist in today's Democratic Party in your mind?
Well, there's standouts. And one is, let me say this on one data point, because I think it's relevant because it gives you confidence you can handle other challenges. In fact, crime is on the way down. But take a look at San Francisco. 3-4 years ago, you said that's the worst example. Now, the Mayor Lurie is a friend of mine. We talk quite frequently. He's turned that city around. He's had a growth agenda. He's had a sense of returning the streets to the residents, not to the gangbangers, drug users, and the homeless. And he's cleaned up his city and has it on the move again. And people are prospering and people are moving back in. Now, there are other mayors that, look, I don't accept this as an example is what I would say. They are doing right on law and order. But you have to actually make the city affordable, accessible, and work. We have to take on. I would say this today about housing. Take all my rules and regs and buildings, put them up against Houston, put them up against Phoenix, pick another city, put them up against Denver. Now, you tell me what's on my book versus all those cities. Why do we have it? If we don't have it, burn it. Get it out of here. Make it easier. I tell this story all the time. When Amy and I were going to rehab our house, took me, I think, 19 months to get a permit and 14 to build it. The paper was longer than the building process. Yeah. It's insane. So we have to be upfront, reforming government, making it more accountable, accessible is a good thing. But also, most importantly, reforming, et cetera. Don't be scared of the fight. I took on a lot of fights on education. Mm-hmm. When I walked out, Sean Reardon at Stanford called Chicago Public Schools the top number one of the top 100. Now, was it easy? No. Did I make mistakes? Yes. But we went from a 56% graduation rate to an 84. 67% of our kids went to college and community colleges. We turned the city around and we turned our schools around. It was tough, but we got to understand we need a growth strategy, not just a redistribution strategy. We've got to make the government accountable to the public, because the public pays the bills and they need the services. And we just can't accept strangling the city based on a series of interests when the biggest interest you have is the city's long-term growth.
On June 5th, I read up that you're beginning a bike tour of New Hampshire, traveling around the state to talk with voters. Rahm Emanuel, you're running for president, man.
Spend free tour. Yeah. I'm thinking very hard about it. Absolutely. And the reason is, I think I have the experience, but more than the experience. Do you have the energy, the drive? Do you have the answers to what ails America? If I think when I go around and I meet people at the diners in New Hampshire, I hear the stories of parents or nurses and doctors or other people around, we're going to do town halls every night. If I think I have what ails America, I'll throw my hat in. If I don't, I'll support somebody else. I'm thinking hard about it because
I think you got it. I think you got it. I've known you for years. I think you got it. I think you, and I think I believe in you. But I got to ask you this though.
Sure.
Do you think a Jewish individual would ever be voted into office? That's my concern, yes, Rahm. When I speak, never speak against you. You know me. We go back years. I never speak against you, but I express apprehension as to whether or not you can win, because we're living in the times where we see anti-Semitism growing, dissipating. And I'm wondering about that for you.
Let me give you three things, okay?
All right.
My faith's not your problem. The fact that the American people have lost faith in America, that's our problem. Let's work on our problem. And if my faith is your problem, don't vote for me, because I'm not changing it for you. It is who I am, and it grounds me morally and ethically in what it means to be a human being. I have fallen short, and my rabbi reminds me of that. But my faith is not your issue. The fact that Americans have lost faith in America and they think America's lost faith in them, that is our collective faith we need to work on. Number two, when I ran for Congress, that seat in Chicago was known as the Polish seat. Dan Rostenkowski, Roman Puchinski, Frank Annunzio, Michael Flanagan, Rob Blagojevich, and along comes Rahm Israel Emanuel. Only 2% of that district is Jewish. People didn't look at me as a Jew. They looked at me as a fighter that could know how to fight for them. And the same thing happened. And I faced anti-Semitism then. I had to show my birth certificate. Nobody else in the five people did. When I ran for mayor, Chicago's population, Jewish population, 2%. I know the people. I met them at the L stops. I met them in the grocery store. I met them on their stoops. They're good people with good values. They saw somebody who would actually turn a school around, a system that would give kids a graduation rate. They voted for Rahm Israel Emanuel, and I faced some very ugliness there too. But when I was an ambassador, somebody had sprayed Nazi insignia on Amy's and my fence. And the next day, we don't know who, somebody went over, cleaned it up, turned the wood around, painted it out, so that wouldn't be there. The American people are good people. I have my confidence in them. I know anti-Semitism exists. I've been a victim of it. But I've also been a victim and a beneficiary of people who will judge me based on my character, my life's work, and based on my values. So, as I said to you at the beginning, don't vote for me if me being Jewish is your problem. Because I'll say one thing, if we're a party that's inclusive, then let's practice it.
Got you. What about people who will hold the city of Chicago against you? Because anytime the city of Chicago comes up, no matter who's in office, because of the years of violence that has existed in the streets of Chicago, I don't care who it is. If you say you're a politician and it's from and you had anything to do with Chicago, somebody's going to bring up the violence in Chicago, and they're going to look to somebody, especially somebody like yourself, who was once the mayor. What do you say to that?
Well, look, I own the good, the bad, and the ugly. And did I make mistakes along the way? Damn right I did. Did I learn from them? Of course I did. And then I had, and also, at the end of the process, Chicago had the lowest robbery, burglary rates, and other types of home crimes in 20 years. But I made mistakes. And the one you got to know is, A, when you make them, B, do you learn from them, and C, do you make sure you improve them the next time? Let me give you an example of that, out of history. Because the only thing you have is learning forward.
Okay.
You have the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
What if history had been different? Kennedy totally screwed up the Bay of Pigs that he inherited from Eisenhower, but he did it. He learned about himself, he learned about the people around him, and he learned how to actually apply forward in the Cuban Missile Crisis the lessons from the Bay of Pigs. So I made my mistakes, and I will own them. I made some good choices and good judgments and good policies. That is life. And if you want perfection, again, don't vote for me, because I may make mistakes. But I will bring all my intellectual energy, all my judgment, all my values, and all my grit to what I do.
Well, you definitely got grit on your side. You definitely got grit on your side and intellectual energy. I can vouch for you on that one. Those two, oh my God. Yeah, definitely got those two going for you. No question about it. Before I let you get on out of here, I'll ask this question respectfully. If you say you're considering running, is it because I know the passion exists there, but is it just because of that, or is it because you look at the other potential candidates on the left and you're like, oh, Lord, we can't have them. I better step up in here. Could it be that? Because I don't like the list that I'm seeing, that I'm hearing about. I don't like it, Ron.
Well, first of all, I got that. Look, my attitude on this is you don't run because you want to block somebody. 2026 will be a referendum on Donald Trump and the rubber stamp Republicans, and they're going to get a whoop.
I think so, too.
2028 is a choice election, not a referendum. And what I'm doing going around the country, laying out stuff on education, laying stuff out on ethics reform, laying stuff out specifically on social media, first on all of those things and how to increase our investment in science and technology. I want to prove that we as Democrats know how to fight for America. I want the American people to say, those are people that actually know, hear, and believe in me. That's why I've made a reform to community colleges. Those are the kids. Those are the people working full-time that are never seen, heard, or respected in Washington. I'd make them at the center as we did in Chicago, which is why the World Bank calls Chicago Community College System the best college career program in America. The very people that can't be seen and heard are the people that I've worked for. I've made my mistakes, but I've never given up fighting for them. And so I'm not trying to block anybody.
Right.
I'm trying to prove as a Democrat, we know how to grow the economy, how to get everybody to be in the winner's circle, not excluded. Take our tax system. One last thing, Stephen A. This tax code today rewards wealth preservation, not wealth creation. It's ass backwards. And you and I, we are rewarded for passing on wealth to another generation. My view, my kids got a loving home and a good education. Rest is up to them. The whole country has actually turned its back, which is why the American people are rightfully angry. The country has turned their back on the American people.
Yeah, but that would be both. That would be the Democrats and the Republicans, in my estimation, Ron.
We dropped the ball, and you know why? You got four big events in the first 25 years of this country. You have a war in Iraq built on a lie. There was never yellow cake, and those responsible never held accountable, and we lost thousands of our promise, America's youth. 4 years later, you had the liar loans. People lost their homes, 7 million of them, and bankers asking for their bonus when they had been responsible and never held accountable. 4 years later, Xi comes into power, and we let Battle Creek fight Beijing all by themselves, and we never actually came to their aid. And then 4 years later, you had COVID. Same thing. And the through line of all that is the establishment took care of itself, and the rest of the public was left holding the bag. That's why people are angry, and they have every right to be.
Last question for you. Data from the last few election cycles shows a historic shift of young men, Rahm, moving away from Democrats. Is the party's rhetoric on identity and culture alienating those voters? And can Democrats win them back without upsetting the progressive base of their party?
Yeah. Well, here's my thing is identity politics is bad strategy and bad politics. And it's proven time again. First of all, when you do identity, the other side gets to do identity.
That's right.
And I don't know if Democrats, the other side's got more identity. Number two, the whole identity politics is based on a false premise. Speak to something that's deeper, that unites people. If you do identity politics, it's based on a politics of division. And people that are enemies, and I don't mean American enemies, China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, exacerbate those enemies. And if you look at President Clinton, President Obama, and President Kennedy, every one of them took on, in one way or another, identity politics. It is a mistake electorally, it is a mistake strategically, and it doesn't find what unites us. It identifies the very thing that breaks us into different subgroups. There is something bigger that needs to appeal to. That is, I believe, like you believe, that we won the lottery ticket of life being Americans. Try that message. Speak to the American part and the American creed. That is a uniting principle that brings Democrats, independents, and some Republicans together.
Former ambassador for Japan, former White House chief of staff, former mayor of Chicago, potentially future presidential candidate for the United States of America, the one and only Rahm Emanuel. Appreciate your time, buddy, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Stephen. Good talking to
you. You know I'm going to have you back on. We'll talk soon, especially as these midterms approach. Be well, buddy.
Okay,
see you soon.
I'm in.
All right.
Bye-bye.
One and only Rahm Emanuel right here with Stephen A. Straight Shooter with Stephen A. 866-967-6887. That's 866-96-POTUS. You're listening live to Straight Shooter with Stephen A. Back with your calls. You heard what Rahm Emanuel said. I know y'all got something to say about that in a minute.